on Sunday mornings, we're going through the Book of Psalms. We've been reading, singing each psalm in turn, and this morning we've come to Psalm 108. Now, in the Bible which I'm using here, which is an edition of the ESV, you've got some words in bold print above the psalm. They read, "With God we shall do valiantly." Those words are actually found at verse 13 of the psalm, but they've been put there at the top by the translators as a heading for the psalm. In a Hebrew copy of the Psalms, you wouldn't have those words at the beginning. They've just been inserted by the translators. So I'm not going to say anything about those words at this point. But now, under those words, you'll see that you've got another heading. In my Bible, it's in block capitals, and it reads, "A song, a psalm of David." Now, I know I've said this many times before, but it's worth saying again. When you've got a heading like that above a psalm, and in the ESV it's always in block capitals, it's not been put there by the translators. It's there in the original Hebrew. It's part of the canonical text of the psalm. In fact, in a Hebrew Bible, it would be numbered as verse 1 of the psalm. It's part of the scriptures, the holy scriptures, which have been given to us by God. So we have to take the headings very seriously. Well, the heading to this psalm tells us two things. The first words are a song, and that's a helpful reminder of what we've got here. This psalm, just like all the others we've been looking at, was written to be sung. It's not just a poem that you read silently, or for that matter, a poem that you read aloud. This psalm is supposed to be sung. And then the next words in the heading tell us that the psalm is a psalm of David. Now, there are many of the psalms that have that heading, and we've talked many times about what that phrase means. But I think it's so important that I'm going to try and remind you again this morning. David was, of course, the name of the first true king of Israel. Before David, a man called Saul was appointed as king. But Saul didn't live up to the responsibilities of kingship at all. He had great natural strength, but he wasn't God's man. He wasn't the man whom God wanted ruling over God's people. And eventually Saul was pushed aside. But then came David. And from the first day when David stepped onto the stage, it was obvious that he was the true king. And God in time brought David to the throne to reign over his people. And God made great promises to David. We'll read some of those promises later. But just to sum them up now, God promised that from David would come a line of kings. David's descendants would rule over God's people. And God promised that he would never take his love away from that line, from that dynasty. And God said that that line would lead to one final king, the ultimate king, a king who would reign over the whole world, a king who would reign forever. He promised that that last king from David's line would transform the world totally. He'd rescue the world from all the damage done by sin. the prophets in Old Testament times often spoke about that ultimate king who would come from David's line. They called him the Messiah, the Anointed One. And each king who came from David's line was seen as one step towards that final king, the Messiah. In fact, you could say that each of the kings who came from David's line was supposed to play the role of the Messiah who was going to come at the end. Each one of them was standing in the Messiah's shoes for a little while. Now, each of those kings, David's son, David's grandson, David's great-grandson, and so on, each of them, of course, had his own personal name, Solomon, Rehoboam, and so on. But Jewish people never forgot that each one of them was a son of David. Each one of them, in turn, was David's heir. Each one of them inherited the promises that God made to David. Each one of them sat on David's throne. So each one of them was thought of as another David, the David for his own generation. So if a Bible writer used the name David, it didn't always mean the original King David. It could be used for the whole of the royal dynasty. And especially it could be used for the final king, the king people were looking forward to, the Messiah. So, for example, when the Lord spoke through Ezekiel, the prophet, about the coming Messiah, he said, "My servant David shall be king over them." He didn't mean that the original David would be brought back from the dead. He meant that that final king from David's line would come, and that he'd be the new David, he'd be the real David, he'd be the David that the whole line had been moving towards. So the name David can be used as a sort of shorthand or code word for the king. The king descended from the original David. It could be used for each king who carried on the line that stretched from the original David to the Messiah, the last David. Just as the name Caesar became the title for each of the emperors of Rome, because each one of them saw himself as the heir of Julius Caesar, just so the name David stands for each of the kings who ruled over God's people from the first David onwards right up to the Messiah, the final king, the Christ. Jesus is the ultimate David. He is the perfect king who stands at the end of the line. He really is everything that the Davids before him should have been but weren't. He's the one who finally does everything that the king over God's people should do. And he inherits all the blessings that God said he would give to the line of David. So we've got a psalm like this in front of us. And we're told at the top that it's a psalm of David. And that could mean it's a psalm written by David. Or it could mean that it's a psalm written about David. Or it could mean that it's a psalm written for David. Or it could mean all three. The important thing is that it's a psalm by or about or for the king. It's a royal psalm. It's a psalm that's linked with the line of David. When you come across any psalm that's headed a psalm of David, you know that the psalm is about the king who comes from David's line. It's about the king who inherits the promises made to David. It's about the king who stands in the shoes of the Messiah. Each such psalm tells us something about what it means to be king over God's people. It may be about the battles that the king has to fight, Or it may be about the suffering that the king has to undergo. Or it may be about the promises that God has made to the king. Or it may be about the prayers that the king has to offer. The Psalms, marked as Psalms of David, are about something that the king does, or something that the king experiences because he is the king. So all those Psalms point forward to the final king, the real king, the Lord Jesus. They all show us something of what the Lord Jesus does and what he experiences. Now, many of those Psalms that are marked a Psalm of David were definitely written by or about the first David, the original David. Others weren't. But in terms of us using the Psalms, it doesn't really matter. Because whichever Psalm was on the throne when a particular Psalm of David was written, the Psalm is always about more than just that individual king. Each king in turn was representing the whole line of kings. Each king in turn was representing the final king, King Jesus, the true son of David. When we open the book of Psalms, and when we see the words of David at the top of a psalm, we can say immediately, this psalm, yes, it's about what one of the kings from David's line felt, or what he prayed, or what he longed for about, or what he suffered. And therefore, we can see Jesus, the ultimate king, in the psalm. Because each of those kings was a forerunner of Jesus. Each of them, as it were, played the role of King Jesus before Jesus came. Everything that was characteristic of the David kings was going to be completely, fully true of Jesus, the ultimate king. One more thing to say about the Psalms of David. When you look at them, you'll realise that in most of them, it's the king himself who does most of the talking, or rather the singing. There's usually in those David Psalms one person who takes the lead, a single person who says, I, me, my. And who is that person? Well, it's the king himself. It's David, the David of his generation. It's the king who sings the main solo part in every David psalm. So take this psalm in front of us, Psalm 108. We see the heading, A Psalm of David. And then we look at the first words of the psalm. My heart is steadfast, O God. I will sing and make melody with all my being. And we ask, well, who is this? Who's this I who first sang those words? And the answer is, it's the king. It could be David himself, or it could be one of the kings descended from David. If it was the first David, he probably wrote the psalm as well as singing it, because he was a brilliant songwriter. If it was one of his descendants, it may have been written for him by one of his team of musicians. But it was still written for the king to sing. And there'll have been some occasion when the king did first sing it in public. And then it was added to the book of Psalms so that it could be used on future occasions. And every time it was used in a festival or in a worship service, it would be whichever king was on the throne who would be expected to sing that solo part. And each of those kings was a forerunner of Jesus. So when we read this psalm, we can read it as if it were Jesus himself who's singing to us. The psalm is the king singing with his people around him. This morning, as we gather, and as we listen to this psalm, and as we meditate upon it, we should be able to hear the voice of Jesus, the King, the real David, singing to us. Well, that's enough of a preamble. Let's actually turn to this psalm then, Psalm 108. And in the case of this psalm, we do know that the words which make up the psalm were written by the original king, David. How do we know that? Well, we know it because this psalm is actually made up of verses from two other psalms that we know were written by David. So the first five verses of the psalm were taken straight from Psalm 57. And the rest of the psalm is taken straight from Psalm 60. Well, we know that Psalm 57 was written by David on a particular occasion. It says it in the heading to the psalm, a miktam of David when he fled from Saul in the cave. And we know that Psalm 60 was written by David on a different occasion, when David strove with Aram Naharaim and with Aram Zobah, and when Joab on his return struck down 12,000 of Edom in the Valley of Salt. We know the exact occasions on which Psalms 57 and 60 were written. Well, somebody has taken a block of words from Psalm 57 and joined them to another block of David's words from Psalm 60 so as to make up this one new psalm. Could have been David himself who did it, or it could have been somebody else on a later occasion. The important thing is that when this psalm was sung, for the first time, it was the king who sang it, the David king. And each time in years to follow, when this psalm was sung in one of the worship services in the temple, it would be the king who would sing it again. Well, what was the situation when this psalm was first sung? Can we work it out from the actual words? I think we can. Look first at verses 5 and 6. This is what they say. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be over all the earth, that your beloved ones may be delivered. Give salvation by your right hand and answer me. It's the king who's singing. He sings to the Lord, answer me. But what's he praying for? He's praying that your beloved ones may be delivered. God's beloved ones means the people God loves, the people who belong to God's chosen nation. At that time, God's beloved ones meant the Israelites. And the king was praying for them. Oh God, act so that your beloved ones may be delivered. He wanted God to rescue them. He goes on to pray, give them salvation by your right hand. So this was obviously sung at a time of crisis. And it wasn't so much that it was a personal crisis where the king himself was suffering. He was praying for the people he reigned over. He was praying for the members of the nation. They were in trouble and there was no hope for them unless God intervened to save them. So the king cries, O God, come to their rescue. O God, bring them deliverance. Well, what was the crisis? What was the danger that was threatening them? Well, go on and look at verse 10. The king sings this, who will bring me to the fortified city. Who will lead me to Edom? The Israelites were at war with the neighbouring nation of Edom. They were actually at war with a whole coalition of neighbours, of nations. We'll talk about that perhaps next week. Here are the Israelites. They're at war with the neighbouring nation of Edom. And they had reached a point in the war where they had to take the offensive and they had to strike into the country of Edom. And they would have to attack the capital city of Edom, which was a strong fortified city. It was called Selah or Petra. And it was located in the high mountains and it was thought of as almost impregnable. So the king asks, who's going to help me when this campaign starts? Who's going to lead me and the armies I lead so that we do reach that fortified city? Who's going to help me as we start our assault on Edom and on its fortified capital? Why is he asking? Isn't it obvious who should be leading them? Well, the answer's in verse 11. Have you not rejected us, O God? You do not go out, O God, with our armies. O grant us help against the foe, for vain is the salvation of man. That was the crisis. That was the terrible situation when this psalm was first sung. The Israelites under their king were at war with a powerful coalition of foreign nations, the Moabites, the Philistines, and especially the Edomites. They'd reached a point in the war where they couldn't stay on the defensive. They had to strike into enemy territory and attack the enemy citadel. But they felt no confidence that their attack would be successful. Why not? Because every other operation they'd mounted in this war so far had gone wrong. Every time they'd gone out to battle, they'd been defeated. And it was because God had turned against them. Have you not rejected us, O God? Cries the king. You don't go out, O God, with our armies. They had the men, they had their weapons, they had their generals, they had their grand strategies. But when they went out to fight, God didn't go out with them. It seemed that God had abandoned them. We're not told why God had abandoned them. Was it because of some sin that the whole nation had committed? Was it simply to humble them, to show them how utterly helpless they were apart from him? Was it to bring them to the point where they would start seeking him with all their hearts? We're not told. So we don't know why God had rejected them, why he no longer went out with their armies. But we do know what the king did at this crucial point in time. This king called the people whom God had entrusted to him, the people he was leading, to seek God together with him. How do we know that? Well, we know it because at the end of the psalm, it's not just the king singing in private on his own. He's singing with lots of other people on behalf of them all. Have you not rejected us, O God? You do not go out, O God, with our armies. O grant us help against the foe. I suppose it's possible that the king called all the people of the nation together for a great meeting in Jerusalem to plead with God for his help. But I don't think so. I think what you've got in this psalm is simply the king gathering his soldiers around him as they prepare to set out on their march against Edom. Can you see the picture? The army of Israel is camped out on the border with Edom. Thousands of men, and they're all dejected. They're all fearful, because they've taken a fearful battering already. They've been defeated in one battle after another. They're tired. Many of them have been wounded. They've seen some of their comrades die. It's obvious that the Lord isn't with them. The Lord has caused them to be defeated again and again. Whenever they've gone out, he's not gone out with them. And it's morning. It's early morning, just before dawn. And a trumpet blast rings through the camp. And the troops know what it means. It means that they'll be marching off to war within the next hour or so. But this is the signal that before they pick up their kit bags and before they strap on their armour, they are to gather to hear what the king has to say to them. So holding torches in hand, remember it's before dawn, it's still dark, the troops crowd together to listen to their king. Perhaps he's standing on the back of a wagon so that they can all see him, they can all hear him. And he looks out over all their faces in the torchlight and they wonder what he's going to say. Is he going to lay into them? Is he going to shame them for the defeats that they've had so far? Is he going to tell them that it's because they hadn't been brave enough? Or they hadn't fought hard enough? Is he going to accuse them of cowardice? Or is he going to urge them to try harder this time? Is he going to make all sorts of promises to them? Well, I know that things will be different this time. Or is he going to admit that the war has been lost and just urge them to go down fighting? No, the king isn't going to do any of those things. He looks out over the sea of faces and he holds out his hand to call for silence. And they see that in the other hand he's holding something. What is it? Is it a sword? Is it a shield? No, he's holding a harp. And then another man steps forward to join him on the platform. And that man's clutching a lyre. And all the soldiers know what's going to happen. Their king is going to sing. He's going to sing to the Lord and to them. I keep saying the king. I think it probably was King David himself, the original King David. I think he was almost certainly the first man to sing this psalm. He was certainly a wonderful musician. He was a wonderful harpist, as well as a vocalist. I think it was David himself who took those two blocks from psalms that he'd written in the past and he wove them together for this occasion. I can't prove it. It may have been one of the kings who came from his line who did it on a later occasion. But I don't know that there ever was another war after David's time when the Israelites had to face the Philistines and the Moabites and the Edomites all together. So, in my mind at least, this is King David rallying his troops before he's marching them off to war. Well, what sort of song would you expect King David to sing on this occasion? After all the defeats, when he knows that God hasn't been going with them to the war up until now, is he going to sing a sad, mournful dirge, a sob set to music, in which he weeps for the defeats that they've experienced? Or is it going to be a loud, aggressive song with a hammering beat to work them up into a frenzy before the war starts? Just listen. We haven't got the music it was sung to on the first occasion. Well, just listen to the words. And then you decide what sort of song it was that the king sang before his people at that crisis in their experience. My heart is steadfast, O God. I will sing and make melody with all my being. Awake, harp and lyre, I will awake the dawn. I will give thanks to you, O Lord, among the peoples. I will sing praises to you among the nations. For your steadfast love is great above the heavens. Your faithfulness reaches to the clouds. It's a joyful song. It's a song of hope and confidence and praise. My heart is steadfast, says the king. He's not in a panic. He's not in turmoil. His heart and his mind are at peace. He knows what he wants to do and he knows what he's going to do. I'm going to sing, he says, and I'm going to make melody with all my being. Awake, O harp and lyre! And his fingers begin to stroke the strings of his harp. And his accompanist next to him comes in with a lyre, so this harmony. I will awaken the dawn, he says. It's a bold picture he uses, as if it's his singing and playing that are going to bring the night to an end and start the morning. But he believes it. Not that his singing literally makes the sun rise, but he believes that his singing to the Lord, his praise, his prayers are going to bring the darkness, the defeat, the despair of the situation to an end. As he, the king, speaks to his God and his Father, a new morning is going to dawn. Light is going to break upon God's people. Oh, the enemies haven't gone away. God's people are still surrounded by hostile, angry, hating nations. But now in this crisis, locked in among those peoples, among those enemies, the king says, I'm going to give you thanks, O Lord, among those peoples. I'm going to sing praises to you among those nations. If the enemies were 10 times as many, and if the situation were 1,000 times more threatening than it was, this king would still be confident. He'd still be singing praises to his God among the nations. And why? Well, the answer's there in verse 4. He's confident, he's joyful, because he knows that the steadfast love of the Lord is great above the heavens. And he knows that the faithfulness of the Lord reaches to the clouds. That's what gives the king his confidence. The fact that the Lord's steadfast love is vast and the Lord's faithfulness is total. We've come across those two terms before, haven't we? Steadfast love and faithfulness. We've seen them lots of times as we've gone through the Psalms. What do they mean? Well, steadfast love, it's just one word in the Hebrew. It means that loyal, unchanging, fixed love that you have for someone to whom you're committed. And faithfulness means utter reliability, your determination not to let down someone to whom you've pledged yourself. Well, God had committed himself to David and to David's line totally. God had made those great promises to David and to the line of kings that came from David. And God knew that, and David knew that God must keep those promises. Why? Because he's a God of perfect, steadfast love. And because he's a God of utter faithfulness. listen to what God had said about David and about David's line. I have found David my servant. With my holy oil I have anointed him, so that my hand shall be established with him. My arm also shall strengthen him. The enemy shall not outwit him. The wicked shall not humble him. I will crush his foes before him, and strike down those who hate him. My faithfulness and steadfast love shall be with him, and in my name shall his horn be exalted. I will make him the firstborn, the highest of the kings of the earth. My steadfast love I will keep for him forever, and my covenant will stand firm for him. I will establish his offspring forever, and his throne as the days of heaven. I will not remove from him my steadfast love, or be false to my faithfulness. His offspring shall endure forever, his throne as long as the sun before me. Like the moon it shall be established forever, a faithful witness to the skies. I was reading then from Psalm 89, and I was just taking a few verses from that psalm about the promises God gave to David and David's line. And the greatest of those promises is that David would have a descendant, an offspring, who will endure forever, whose throne will be established forever. And again in that psalm, God says, these promises are guaranteed by my steadfast love and my faithfulness. When you see those two terms together, steadfast love and faithfulness, anywhere in the Old Testament, again and again they're used to summarize God's total commitment to David and to the line of kings from David, right down to the final king, King Jesus, the king who's going to reign forever. So back to Psalm 108. What have we got here? It's a time of crisis, when God's people are threatened, when there's been defeat after defeat. But David is standing singing God's praises still. And he's singing confidently. He's singing joyfully. He's singing because he's certain that God will hear his prayers and that all will be well in the end. And what makes him so certain, what makes him so confident? It's the fact that God has given him great promises. God has promised that his descendant will be the greatest of the kings of the earth. God has promised him that one of his descendants will reign forever and ever and will overthrow all his enemies. And God's promises cannot fail, because he's a God of total, steadfast love and faithfulness. The Israelites were marching to war under the leadership of David. Could David be sure that this campaign would be successful? Could he know that they would reach the fortified city of Edom? Could he know that they would defeat their enemies in the battle that would be fought there? No. Couldn't be sure of those things. But he could be sure that in the end, all would be well. Because whatever happened in the short term, one day Messiah would come. One day all the enemies of God's people would be defeated. One day all wrong would be put to right. One day David's great descendant would take the throne as the highest of kings on earth, and his reign would never end. The forces of darkness couldn't triumph in the end. The people who hated God and who hated God's people and who hated God's king, they couldn't put out the light. The dawn would come. Yes, it seemed that God had rejected his people and his chosen king. He hadn't been helping their armies. He had allowed them to be defeated. But that couldn't be the end of the story. God must turn again to David and to the line of David, because that's what he promised to do. And the Lord Yahweh is a God of steadfast love and faithfulness. If he promises something, that promise can never be broken. So this king could sing songs of praise with a confident, steadfast heart. That's what he's doing in verses 1 to 4. But he can do more than that. He can turn to prayer. And he can pray with equal confidence. What does he pray for? Does the king pray that the army will reach their objective without being intercepted, ambushed? Does he pray that the guards defending the gates of Petra will all run away? Does he go through each detail of the battle plan and pray that at each point it'll be successful? No, he prays much more simply, much more boldly than that. Verse 5, be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be over all the earth. He prays that God will win himself glory. He prays that God will do something that will lead to people everywhere fearing him, honouring him, worshipping him, giving him all the glory. And what will that something be? Verse 6, that your beloved ones may be delivered. Give salvation by your right hand and answer me. He's praying that God will rescue his people and thus win the glory. And for whose sake will God do it? Give salvation, he prays, by your right hand, and answer me. God will rescue his people because he loves their king. And he's made great promises to their king, and because the king prays for them. We're not going to move on to the second half of the psalm this morning. God willing, we will next week. Let's instead just pause. Let's pause and let's think about ourselves. Here we are. Soldiers. Enrolled under the banner of King Jesus. Committed to fighting for him. Fighting against sin in all its forms. Against sin in our own lives. Against sin in the life of the church. Against sin in the world. Fighting against Satan and all Satan's forces. Fighting against every power that stands to oppose God and his glory. We do not wrestle with flesh and blood. We wrestle against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. We have to attack great fortified cities where Satan's power has been entrenched, perhaps for generations. The weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but have divine power to destroy strongholds. We're fighting to tear Satan's prisoners from his hands. We're fighting to set men free from the grip of false ideologies and unbelief. We're fighting to capture their minds. We destroy arguments and every lofty opinion raised against the knowledge of God, and we take every thought captive to obey Christ. Every day we are being called to march once more against the forces of evil. Every day the campaign begins again. And at times we are deeply discouraged. And we look back and we say, have you not rejected us, O God? You do not go out, O God, with our armies. So often it feels as if the war is going against us. So often it seems that God has withheld his power. We fought to make the gospel of God known to the people around us. And the vast majority are still oblivious. They're ignorant even of what the gospel is. We've tried to fight that battle, and it feels as if we've lost. We fought to win our own loved ones. We've longed to see our own children rescued from the grip of Satan. But so many of them are still held firmly in his hands. We feel as if we've lost that battle. We fought to keep gospel churches open, and we've seen one after another close, and it feels as if we've lost that battle. We fought to rescue our fellow believers from false, dangerous ideas, but those ideas seem to have spread through all the churches and still to be spreading. We feel as if we're losing that battle. How few successes we've seen. How many failures we've seen. So is it a time for despair? Is it a time for retreat and surrender? Well, there is one person who doesn't think so. And who's that? Our King. King Jesus, the great descendant of David, he's standing among us still. And this morning he's singing this psalm. His heart is steadfast. He's not quivering with fear. He's singing and he's making melody with all his being. He can see the enemies on every side. He can see the forces of ungodliness and unbelief and just how powerful they are. He can see Satan's forces. And he gives thanks. He gives thanks to the Father among the peoples. He sings praises among the heathen. He's not in despair. He's full of confidence and joy and praise. Why? Because God his Father has made colossal promises to him. He's going to conquer the nations. He's going to save all his elect, countless millions of them, more than any man can number. He's going to defeat Satan and all the forces of evil totally. He's going to crush them until there's no trace of them left in his universe. He's going to renew the whole earth. And he's going to make it the throne room of heaven. And he's going to sit on the throne forever. God has promised him victory, power, glory, honor, dominion, praise. And God, his God, is a God of total steadfast love and utter faithfulness. King Jesus must win. And he must win totally. Listen to King Jesus singing this morning. He's singing the praises of God his Father, and his face is untroubled. There's joy in his song, and as he sings, he prays. So listen to his prayer. This is what King Jesus is praying today. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be over all the earth. Well, will that happen? Will the prayers of Jesus be answered? Will the glory of God one day fill the whole earth? How could the prayers of Jesus not be answered? And what does that mean for us? He prays that your beloved ones may be delivered. We're going to be delivered. Because that's what Jesus is praying for. We're going to be rescued at last totally from sin and all the consequences of sin, Adam's sin and our own sin. Satan will have no more power to torment us and to taunt us and to tempt us. He won't be able to take our happiness away from us any longer. Jesus, the King, our King, the King whom God has given to us, the King to whom he's promised steadfast love, is praying for us. Give salvation, he prays, by your right hand, and answer me. And that's the prayer that Jesus sings for us. Yes, we've had our defeats. And they have been very many. And they have been very painful. And yes, there may be many more defeats to come. Yes, at least where we live in the UK, it does feel that the war is going against us. And many battles are being lost. But the war can't be lost in the end. Because Jesus is our King. He's the King who inherits all the promises made to David. Jesus leads us. Jesus sings as we go into battle. And the song he sings is a song of praise and thanksgiving. And in his singing he prays for us. And his song will awaken the dawn. Can you see in your mind's eye that morning long ago when David first sang this psalm in the midst of his discouraged troops? And as he sang, the sun rose over the horizon and those soldiers lifted their faces as a new light shone upon them. The darkness gave way to light. Well, the night time of this world is coming to an end. The darkness is going to be defeated. King Jesus is singing, and his song will usher in the dawn. The morning is near. It may feel as if there's darkness all around us, but you know what they say? For the darkest hour is the hour before the dawn. Morning is near. Weeping may endure for a night, and we've done a great deal of weeping in these recent years. Weeping may endure for a night, but joy comes in the morning. The steadfast love, the faithfulness of God, his promises to King Jesus guarantee our eternal joy.